you've heard of this thing called the Sunday scaries, right? Where people have this feeling of dread because they have to go back to work the next day. I can tell you, if you get the Sunday scaries, you will never be successful, right? You
have the second. I get the Sunday scaries and I'm still pretty successful. Okay. Can you get them this much? And that's fine. Sunday's a great day. It's family. Then I'm like, oh shit, I got to get to bed. I get up early. So I challenge that. Welcome to the Futures Edge. I am Jim Urio. That's Bob Iacino, the co-host. And in the middle, Jared Dillian, who is the author of The Daily Dirt Nap, the author of Me Worry. Bobby, can you show the book?
Yeah, right here. Got it right in front of me. Hang on. Cover my face.
There it is. No Worries, the book that I just finished. With Bobby, I know you're going to be shocked as hell to know that I'm actually prepared for this interview. I'd like a pat on the back from you right now. Because normally, Jared, I come into these things maybe kind of shooting from the hip a little bit.
A virtual pat on the back.
We know Jared from Twitter. And the first thing I'd like to address is that, it's so funny how, like, you feel like you've become friends with people, which I actually don't. Like, I have no problem with that. I think it's excellent. I like Jared. I like what you put out. I can tell your personality is someone I'd get along with. Now, when I listen to the book, the narrator of the book, he's very enthusiastic. And I was thinking to myself, if Jared was reading that line, it would have been a kind of more edgy and crabby like most of us are. Did you listen to the book, Jared, or no?
No, I can't listen to it.
Right. So if you did, you'd know what I mean. Like, he's very energetic and enthusiastic. I think if that was Jared or me reading the book, we'd be like, dude, get a grip. You know
what I mean? I mean, I could have read the book, but that is so tedious, like 16 hours in front of a microphone reading a book. I'd much rather pay someone else to do it. And the narrator is a guy named LJ Ganser. He narrated Street Freak, my first book, and he narrated Those Bastards, my book of essays that came out last year. I use him for all my books. He's terrific.
Yeah, no, he is good. I just noticed that he's very enthusiastic, which I thought was cool. 16 hours. So you a book that size, which we'll call it a small, short to medium sized book, that's 16 hours of reading?
No, it's about 6 hours when it's cut down, right? But in terms of doing multiple takes and stuff like that, it'll take you that long to read the book.
Interesting, because I've done some voiceovers for things I've written for the CME, and I thought it was cool because they're just like, if you fuck up a sentence, just start it right over again, and we'll figure it all out in the end, which I thought was a good thing. But anyway, still the book. Bobby, you finished the book too?
I did.
So let's start with that, right? Let's start with more nonsense.
I actually made notes as I was writing or reading the book. Of things that I'm curious about. And one of the things I wanted to bring up, by the way, if anyone has kids in their like 15, 16 range that you can actually get to finish a book, okay, get off TikTok, get off Snap, Face, Chat Book, or whatever the hell it is, and actually finish a book, I couldn't recommend this more if you had a kid who was actually seriously trying to figure out his or her or they life. Because as I read through this, so you get all this, Jared goes into this whole thing, Jimmy, I don't know if you remember this, where you go into this thing like, if I save my Dunkin' Donuts coffee in 40 years, I'll have, you know, $260,000 invested in the market. And no one does it. Right. You know, people do that all the time. Like, I've had conversations with people. There was a period of time where I was out with, you know, self-employed, single at the time, and I had no health insurance, right? And Obamacare came out, and I was considered to have a pre-existing condition that I think I've cured myself, quite frankly. But to get Obamacare, it was going to be somewhere in the range of $1,800 a month, plus my prescriptions that I was paying for out of pocket anyway was going to go up under Obamacare. So I said, screw it. But I thought to myself, you know what, $1,600 a month, I'm going to put half of that away and say, this is my I got hit by a truck fund, right?
Yeah.
And I never did it. And that was the thing about the coffee. So in the book, he, you know, again, gives the example.
We're going to at some point in time let Jared talk, right? We'll just keep selling your book. Jared, you just sit down. We're going to sell your book.
Yeah. No, but what I was trying to point out is so he goes through this whole thing. And honestly, Jared, my honest reaction was, here we go again. Don't buy the Dunkin' Donuts coffee, right? And he goes, drink your damn coffee, basically, is what he said. Buy your coffee and drink it because you won't be happy. So I wanted to give this to all my nieces because I think the brilliant part of the book, and I want to understand how you came to this, is getting three things right. So can you go into those three things for people who haven't read it and so that they can understand what I'm talking about, why I was so shocked by it?
Yeah, I mean, basically what the main focus of the book is the idea that most people believe it is a million small decisions that determine whether you have money, when in fact, it's just a handful of big decisions. And you can do the math on this. And I did the math in the book. Like the coffee, it's $4 a day. If you didn't drink coffee for the rest of your life, it would be $36,000. And maybe if you invested it, it would be $100,000. But if you go shopping for a house, okay, and you want a house that is 500 square feet bigger, it is going to cost $200,000 more. And the interest on a 30-year mortgage, you're going to pay $250,000 in interest over the life of that mortgage. So what people generally do is they get cheap about the little stuff. But when it comes to the big stuff like houses and cars and your education, they're not cheap at all. They're the opposite. And they have their priorities totally backwards. So really all you have to do is get three things right, the house, the car, and the student loans. And you don't have to worry about the little stuff. You don't have to worry about going out to lunch and paying $20 at Chipotle. It just does not matter. The little stuff does not matter. And in this country, we kind of have this culture where we are taught that the little things matter. Like, you remember that Navy admiral that gave that commencement speech like 10 years
about
ago?
About making the bed?
Yeah, about making your bed. I don't make my bed. I'm a very successful person. I don't make my bed. I just leave it the way it is, and I get in it at night. If I make the bed, it's like 5 minutes out of my day that I can't spend on something else.
I swear to God, I thought the same thing when I heard him saying it. My wife makes the bed, don't get me wrong, but I don't make the bed. It's so funny when the education part of it. My daughters both went basically to undergraduate for free. They both got like these women in engineering and women in business scholarships. But my older daughter, when she went back to school, and she's an adult woman, I did not pay for grad school, but I do know she borrowed money for grad school. And you said, you never borrow for education. I'm like, shit, now we fucked this up. And then you're like, unless you're going to Harvard or Stanford. And I'm like, okay, that's okay then. She borrowed for that. So you put the caveat in for my daughter, and I appreciate that. So
yeah, I mean, grad school is a killer. Like, grad school is where most universities make their money. They have the highest margin in grad school. And you go to a grad school, if you go to like a second or third tier grad school program, especially law, like it's a common misconception that maybe back in the 80s, I remember when I was a kid in the 80s, if you were a doctor or a lawyer, you were rich, right? And fast forward to today, 40 years later, and that's not the case. And you have lawyers in this town in Myrtle Beach, you have lawyers on food stamps. Like, it is not a recipe for success. So if you go to a third tier law school and you come out and you're practicing family law or injury law or something like that, you're making $45,000 a year and you have $200,000 in student loans. Doesn't make any sense. You know, so no. Grad school is a killer.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And again, she, you know, she has some pretty good prospects. I don't go over exactly what her loans are, but now she's back to her old job making, you know, making $125,000 a year, which she was at before she left. So hopefully she'll build her war chest and pay off her loan pretty quickly. The car part of it, I thought was fascinating too. And you run the numbers to an earning car. And I've always, it's so funny because I've always been in exactly the same camp. Back in the 90s, early 2000s, Bobby was on the trading floor. We needed wheelbarrows to take home the kind of money we were making back then. I still drove a Honda Civic. My brother asked me, why the hell do you drive a Honda Civic? I said, one, because it always starts when I want it to start. But two, when I drive up to a restaurant or place, if people are going to make judgments on me, I'd rather make the wrong judgment. It's nobody's goddamn business how I'm doing at my job. What kind of, you said you did buy the Corvette. Tell me what went into that thinking.
You know, when the mid-engine Corvette came, this was like 2019, and they had the design on the mid-engine Corvette. And I was like, man, this is the coolest car of all time. So I went to the dealership and they said I had to order it. So I ordered it. And then the pandemic happened So my car was delayed. And then they had one sitting in the showroom that used to be owned by Ricky Craven, NASCAR driver. Okay. And he basically was flipping it. So I bought that. The whole story behind that in the car dealership with them trying to get me to take out a loan is hilarious. You probably saw that in the book.
I did. Yeah. Yes.
But I, at that point in my life, I said, okay, you know, I'm 40 whatever years old. I've been very successful. My business is stable. A Corvette is, it's also not a McLaren, right? Like it's, I mean, it's a six figure car. It's a, it cost me $113,000, but it's not a Ferrari. It's not a Lamborghini. I said, I can afford that. So,
up a bit, right. Yeah. I mean, you're not going for the green. You're laying up a little bit with the Corvette.
Yeah.
You're not going where you could go.
Yeah. You guys could probably just sit and talk about cars and horsepowers and things. And Jared's not even Italian, and he still likes horsepower and cars. Do you have any gold chains, Jared, or no?
Yeah, this shit.
See, he could be one of us, Bobby.
For one of us. Yeah. So it's funny you bring up the car thing. There's a couple of places in the book where 99% of the book, I went, that's dead on, that's dead on, that's dead on. And there were a couple of places where I disagreed. And I want you to talk me down from one particular ledge. I married a CF, okay, and I'm a high roller, in theory, in theory.
By the way, for now, you people who are watching out there, CF is cheap fucker, high roller is people who spend money. Anyway, go on.
And the odd thing about it is because this is my second marriage, the first one was not correct. In the first one, we were both high rollers. And I'll tell you where all the money in the wheelbarrows, I didn't keep a lot of that. But in this particular case, I married a girl who comes home one day and she says to me, I got good news and bad news. What's the bad news? I bought 9 dresses. What's the good news? I spent a total of $36. I was at Goodwill, right? And I was like, oh, I'll never buy it. She comes back with a bunch of clothes for me like a week later and they were all fine, right? So I've now a roller, right? I'm not a high roller anymore.
You're a medium roller.
Yeah. And she's cheap. She's not a cheap fucker anymore. You know, so we kind of met in the middle. Is that something that you would say is kind of an outlier, like it's a fat tail as opposed to what would happen in a normal situation? Because you said the two will end in disaster in the book.
No, that's a good point. I mean, let me ask you a question. Do you ever fight about money?
No, because I let her decide.
Okay.
So if there's a decision to be made, like the other day I asked her if I could buy a t-shirt. I mean, I can afford a t-shirt, but I asked her if I could buy it. And she's like, okay, fine, but don't upgrade our seats on Spirit. Like she makes me trade.
No. Amy, like the other thing that people come back to me on is the whole thing about keeping your money separate. Because I say in the book that, you know, in my marriage, I've been married for 26 plus years. When we moved in together, my wife said, I want to keep our money separate. And I said, totally fine. That's fine. And we have never fought about money. And some people have come back to me and says, look, like we have joint accounts, we pool our funds, and it works. Like we don't fight about money either. And I said, great. If you have a system that works, like keep doing it. Like I'm not saying that your way is the wrong way. Like if you have a way that works, then do it. But if you were telling me that you had joint accounts and you were fighting about money, then maybe try my way. So my wife and I were both CFs, but she was a bigger CF than me. And over time, I've drifted towards the high roller and she's still a CF. So I bought a very expensive piece of jewelry a couple of weeks ago and I didn't tell her how much it costs. I told her friend how much it costs and then her friend told my wife. And she's like, you spent what on a bracelet? And I was like, you know, but we didn't fight about it. She's like, it's your money. Like if we keep our money separate, so it's your money. You can spend whatever you want.
But what about in a situation where, you know, wife perhaps stays home to take care of the kids? You don't have any children. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
So in a lot of families that happens. And then it seems like, you know, almost illogical when you're making, you know, like she had no money when she was staying home, taking care of the kids. But I mean, so obviously it matters on the situation, correct?
Yep, absolutely.
So to the house thing. So you talked about, see, I kind of fancied myself a real estate investor. Up until about 6 months ago, we owned 4 different properties. We owned a, by the way, there's the book, people. No worries. Jared Dillian. Is Dillian an Irish name?
Yeah.
Bingo.
Fantastic. It's a British name, but I actually, my father was adopted. So I actually am. I'm not even really a Dillion, so it's kind of kind of weird. So
right, hold on. I was going to show my book too.
Recently, I've got a family with about 26 nieces and nephews. The oldest one being 26, so they're all entering this age where they should read your book. One of them recently, after 1 year of college, decided to pull back and go to the Fire Academy. And I think that's brilliant. One of the most successful guys, I'm 58, Jimmy and I are the same age, right? And one of the most successful guys I know, I went to college with him, his name's Tommy Romano, great guy, was in the Fire Academy while he was in school, right? And when he got out of school, he basically, you know, we drank and we hung out. And he was a great guy. Got out of school, becomes a full-time fireman. At the time, 2 days on, 2 days off, 2 days on, 2 days off, 2 days on, 7 days off. That was the schedule. And in those 7 days, he would go work part-time in construction. And after about 8 years of that, he started taking his off days and buying really cheap houses, fixing them with his own hands, selling them. And by the time he got to full retirement, as a firefighter at about 53 years old, he had a full pension, about 10 rental units, 3 homes of his own. He had sold multiple properties. He's one of the most successful guys I know. He can't even remember how to get to our college, let alone use anything that he may have picked up. So this nephew of mine decided he wanted to go to the Fire Academy. And I said, you need to read this book. And I ordered him a copy of your book, because I want him to not use that time. So in the chapter, or not to waste the off time, right? Just kind of lying around. So in the chapter about education, you talk about the importance of education for most people, right? But you also talk in there, you briefly mentioned trade schools and things like that. What do you think the right path is given with the cost of education, just generally? I'm not necessarily referring directly to the book. Obviously, we're generalizing, but what's your thoughts on that?
So two things. The first thing is, we have a huge oversupply of people with college degrees. We have a huge undersupply of people without college degrees. Okay. So 2017, I went to a beer distributor in Wisconsin. It was a friend of a friend. And I was talking to the guy who runs the beer distributor, and he was telling me that he was hiring college graduates and paying them $55,000 a year to do sales. And he was hiring high school dropouts and paying them $110,000 a year to drive trucks, right? So this is just supply and demand of labor, right? We have too many people with college degrees that are driving down white collar wages, and we have an undersupply of people without college degrees, which is driving up wages. And that's still happening. You know, if we were supposed to have like a higher education bubble that was supposed to burst during the pandemic, it didn't happen. People are still going to college, and you're still going to have this mismatch in supply and demand. So by all means, you know, like going to a trade school, there's no dishonor in that. You can make a shit ton of money.
So just to add to that, I own a bar in Palatine, a bar restaurant. Every day the contractors come by about 5 o'clock. They meet, they become my buddies. One of them makes more money than the next. They're plumbers, they're contractors, they're electricians. And it's just, it's amazing to me. My question though is the money imbalance, like we're taught to believe in economics that, you know, that will fix everything. If a plumber or a welder can make $100,000, but we have a whole generation of parents who keep telling kids they must go to school and would look down on plumbers, which a plumber's my hero. The plumber, you only, anything breaks on Christmas Eve and he's got to come. So the plumber, I buy my plumber a drink every time I see him. But how do we change that perception, or is it just a process?
It's just a process. It just takes time. The other thing I wanted to point out is the story you tell me about the guy that went, that was a fireman and he was renovating properties. Yep. You know, that actually pertains to the first chapter of the book, right? Which is, you have to want it, right? In order to get money, you have to want money, right? And a lot of people don't want money. You know what he could have done? He could have just been a fireman, and he could have fucked off on his days off and not done any of that stuff. And he would have made 70 or 80 grand a year, and he would have had a nice retirement. That's it. But on his time off, he chose to get involved in real estate. He chose to renovate properties. He did that in his spare time. And now he's a very wealthy man. Money is a choice. We all get to choose how much money we have. I choose how much money I have. You guys choose how much money you have. I'm sure there's things that you could do to make more money, and you don't because you have whatever reason. There's things I could do to make more money. You know, I mean, there's all things we could be doing to make more money. There's 24 hours in the day, and it comes down to you have to want it.
So talk more about that if you could, because I think you're right to bring up the first chapter of the book. You talked about working being something you should be excited about because you're being productive. Can you talk more about that? Because I think people look at that wrong.
You know, Mike Bloomberg, you know, I have my differences with Bloomberg, but he's one of the most successful people in the country. And he had a quote where he said his favorite time of the week was Sunday night because he was so excited to get to work the next morning and do stuff.
And I think what Michael Bloomberg means is he doesn't get the Sunday scaries and he's not scared to go to work. Do you think he's really giddy like a child, like I get to go solve problems and get to have a bunch of people ringing my phone and wanting a different piece of me? Is that really believable to you?
Yeah, it is. I believe it. Yeah.
A Sunday, like for me, I start working on Sundays about 4 o'clock. I usually have some writing assignments due for the week that I like to get ahead of. And sometimes, you know, I'll not finish them because some different market things have to be kind of pieced into them. But that's how I handle it. I get right to the job. Because Sunday at 4 o'clock, you know, a lot of other people don't feel like hanging out. I can't be, you know, at a bar drinking all the time. So I become productive at 4 o'clock, and I seem to have solved that problem. Sounds pretty good, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, you know, I'm a full-time writer. You know, on the weekends, I'm on the couch with a laptop and I'm writing. In November, I have a collection of short stories coming out. Literally just the last week, I started working on a novel. Like, I'm always working on stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I don't have to do any of these things. I have a newsletter business. It's very profitable. If I wanted to sit around and watch TV, I could do that, but I'm constantly doing stuff.
Okay, so Bobby talked about his friend who flipped houses. I, up until about 6 months ago, I had 4 different homes. We sold one. Now we have 3. I've made some decent money in real estate. You, though, as it seemed the tone was that it might not be the greatest thing. And I know when we're going to get to the awesome portfolio, which I loved, by the way, and you talked about owning real estate, but you talked about it owning real estate that other people manage and other people. Are you opposed to an individual trying to make money on real estate? Or you think it's a good idea?
Dude, people become billionaires investing in real estate. I'm definitely not opposed to it. Just the point that I tried to make in the book is that there's a lot more risk than people really appreciate, right? Because if you're buying houses and renting them out, you're probably doing it in the same geographic area. You're totally undiversified. You're at the whim of zoning laws and interest rates and all kinds of forces outside of your control. I think a lot of people have been led to think that investing in real estate is easy where it's actually hard. That's the only point I was trying to make.
Okay, no, and that actually makes perfect sense. And I agree with you too. Some of the properties I've had have been more of a pain in the ass than they're worth. And I've not lost money on them. But when I look at the money I've made and think of the amount of mental anguish that goes into it, I get exactly what you're saying.
So I actually have a real issue with casual real estate investors because I think a lot of the time they exaggerate mentally what they've made. And I actually just went through this exercise with somebody that I'm really close with who talked about a 3-flat that he's owned for years. And he said, well, I bought it at this and it's now worth this. So I've made money. I'm not saying you didn't make money, right? But I'm saying, okay, now what was the rent? What was the taxes? How many times do you have to change the heating? How many times do you have to put in new floors? How many times did you not collect rent from somebody who left? And you had to cover it for a couple of months, blah, blah, blah. I've always had that. I've always owned one property at a time, never owned more than one. Jared, I want your opinion on this. I don't look at my home as an investment at all. I look at it as a place where I live. I look at my portfolio as an investment. And because of that, I've actually lived below my means in terms of structure almost every single time I've owned a house. Not when I was married to another high roller, but almost every single time I've lived below my means. And I would argue that right now I'm living at my means and I hate it. So what's your thought on that?
Why do you hate it first though?
I just, I walk around and I'm stressed out.
Oh, because I don't need this. I don't need this. Right. Yeah,
I've got too much room here. So this is why this book struck me the way that it did. That's why the Dunkin' Donuts coffee thing struck me the way that it did. Because the coffee makes people happy. I have an espresso machine at home. I was just drinking an espresso, right? And they're 70 cents a cup, right? And my brother-in-law says to me, you know, if you grind your own beans, it's 30. Fuck you. Seriously, fuck you. I put in a little pod. It makes really good coffee. It's 40 cents. Okay, I'm going to be fine. Okay. So, and then I'm like, I'm ordering them this book. But so anyway, am I nuts for thinking that way? I mean, do you think, you know, I understand that the house, I just don't look at a house as an investment.
You know, so two things. Is a house an investment? No, it's not. It is and it isn't. A house depreciates. It is negative carry. You constantly have to plow money into it for maintenance and insurance and property taxes. Stocks and bonds give you income. They're positive carry. A house is negative carry. Having said that, a lot of people, their house is their only investment, and it works out really well because they don't mark it to market.
Is that more like the comp would be kind of a low interest?
Yeah. Like because you don't have some app on your phone that's telling you the value of your house every day, and you're not trying to time the market and get out at the right time. You just own it.
Fucking brilliant.
Yeah. So the other thing I will say is you were talking about living at your means and it makes you uncomfortable. I think we all have a moral responsibility to live at our means, not above our means, not below our means, but at our means. I have a friend who makes roughly $3 million a year. He's got roughly $30 million in the bank, and he lives in a $400,000 house. Doesn't make any sense. He's the cheapest guy I know. You know, he could easily live in like a $6 million house without breaking a sweat. And to me, I find that offensive. That offends me because how he derives enjoyment from his money is logging onto his bank account and counting the commas, right? He logs onto his bank account and counts his money, but he could be spending it on stuff. He could get a really nice car. He could really get a nice house. Like he can afford this stuff. So It really bothers me personally when people live very far below their means.
Well, see, but what? Okay, so you grew up from humble means, yep. Correct? Yeah. So you know, I grew up in a house where 11 people lived. My family just owned a third of the house. My grandpa, my aunt owned the other 2/3. We had a 2,000 square foot home with 11 people in it. It was 2,200 square feet. Let's call it. So roughly, let's call it 200 square foot a person. My daughters have long ago moved out. And we live in a, you know, 3,000 square foot home, not huge, but the two of us. And it always seems to me that it's just a waste of space. And it's a pain in the ass to keep up. Not that it's not from the money part of it. Like the fence blew down the other day. And like, I don't want to do this shit anymore. So would you be offended if someone like me, who could basically live within reason wherever I want, gets a small townhouse that's about 1,200 square feet, doesn't have to mow any lawn or fix any fences? That sounds logical, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you guys said you were 58, so you're getting closer to downsizing. You know, I just turned 50, so I'm a little bit younger. I can tell you that I am just finishing up building a 10,000 square foot house.
Mm-hmm. Kick ass.
So I'm building a 10,000 square foot house. It's in South Carolina. And one of the reasons I did that was because it's so cheap here. This is the only place in the country where you can do something like that and, you know, have it be reasonably priced, you know. That's
outstanding.
Yeah.
Can we flip over before we get to the awesome portfolio? I want to kind of have a macro discussion about things that are going on because I know that's something you care quite a bit about as well. So like when I look at the macro landscape, and I look at, you know, the government spending and things like that, there's a lot that I worry about. That's why I was attracted to the awesome portfolio. By the way, when I keep saying the awesome portfolio, that's what Jared refers to in his book. And it's very, very interesting. But that's why I'm kind of attracted to that, because it seems like it's fairly conservative and built into some perhaps panic events. Do you foresee a panic event coming?
I was thinking about that today. I kind of don't. The VIX is 13 now. I spent some time looking at the charts. I'm not seeing any signs of exhaustion. I mean, we got plenty of potential catalysts between now and the election, but technically this market does not look like it's topping soon. You know what I mean?
What about the dollar, and what about a potential for a debt crisis?
You mean government debt, right?
Yep.
Yeah. We are running a deficit of about $2 trillion a year. Bond market is absorbing it reasonably well. You know, look, like I remember when I started working at Lehman Brothers in 2001, and Alan Abelson was writing Up and Down Wall Street for Barron's. And pretty much every week, he would put a chart in Up and Down Wall Street of total debt to GDP, right? And the chart was going from the lower left to the upper right, and total debt to GDP at the time was about 200%. Well, now we're at like 400%, right? But if you thought we were going to get a margin call 23 years ago, we didn't, right? I mean, it's not going to matter until it matters. Like a lot of things in finance, like it's a problem. Everybody knows it's a problem, but it's not going to matter until it matters. You know, there was a time about 6 to 12 months ago when the auctions were getting kind of sloppy and people, you know, you definitely saw some upward pressure on interest rates because of issuance. But really, like, in order for us to really get a margin call, we need bid to cover on auctions to get like 1.5. We need rates shooting 50, 100, 150 basis points higher. Like, we need to get tens to like 8 or 9% before we can really call it a crisis, you know? And I think ultimately that's going to happen. I think that's going to happen, I don't know, sometime in the next couple of years, but who knows?
I do too.
So here's a question for both of you. And Jimmy, why don't you answer first so that Jared can have the bulk of the time. The Federal Reserve said Tuesday it officially saw net negative income of $114.3 billion. In 2023, a record loss to expenses related to managing the central bank's short-term interest rate target. Does this matter, A? And B, if it doesn't, will it ever matter from a perspective of the Fed just losing billions of dollars because of their interest rate moves?
When I look at that, I don't think it matters that much. And by the way, I do think there are some things that matter a lot. Jared talked about the bond market sucking up issuance. And I think a lot of that has been focused on the short end because of all that money that was in reverse repo, you know, even back to May, that's now it's down to $500 billion. The fact that the Fed is losing money, whatever, you know, that's just, you know, the government writes them a check just like they do everybody else. I mean, I think that everybody lives this YOLO life and thinks they're going to get bailed out. But I do think the bigger worry, like one thing I disagree with Jared on, I do think as soon as that reverse repo money runs out, and the Treasury can't just tap that pool of liquidity so easily, then we go back to perhaps sloppy auctions. And I do think they could push 10-year rates up to 5.5% or 6% even this year, provided the Fed doesn't come back in and start buying bonds again. But Jared, you can take that question because I don't really know.
Well, the question is, does it matter from a financial standpoint or does it matter from a political standpoint? I mean,
either way.
Political is part of the reason I think that they'll cut rates, even though I don't think they should. So either one or both.
Yeah, I mean, the Fed losing money, I mean, in the context of a $7 trillion budget, the Fed losing $100 billion is kind of, I can say that if the Fed lost $500 billion, then I think people would focus more attention on it. But that's only going to happen if rates back up a lot. I mean, they bought treasuries across the curve doing QE at 1%, and, you know, they're wearing it. So
do you think that they're going to, if what I think is going to happen happens, and that as soon as the Fed exhausts reverse repo and has to go, you know, spread out along the curve, and we remember back those sloppy auctions that happened a few months back, if we start having consistently sloppy auctions, is the Fed going to step in and buy 7 through 30 years? Or are they going to let the curve steepen out? Do they want that? What do they want?
So what you're talking about is yield curve control, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is the Fed ever going to do yield curve control? And that will only come at a time when we are at the point of maximum pain when it comes to interest rates, right? So right now, interest rates are high. Mortgage rates are 7%. You know, people are adjusting to higher mortgage rates, right? But I think if mortgage rates went to 10% and people were squealing, I think there would be pressure, there would be political pressure on the Fed to do something about it, at which point they would cap the yield curve. They do like they did in the 30s. And that's when gold goes parabolic, you know?
Right. That's why I own gold, because I think they could conceivably do that. Bobby?
Yeah. What is your stance on if, okay, so as a strategist, I say this all the time, my job is not to decide whether the Fed is doing the right thing, but what they're going to do, right? And I think they're going to cut rates, and I don't think they should. Do you have a stance on that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. It's insane for the Fed to cut rates right now. I mean, if you go back into the latter half of 2023, the data was getting softer, okay?
Right.
And the stock market was a lot lower. Like the S&P got down to 4150, and that's when you had that Waller speech where you basically got the pivot, and they said, look, like, we have inflation at 2.5%. We have core PCE at 2.5%. Fed funds is at 5.5%. So we have real rates of 3%, which is restrictive. So we should cut rates, right? And they were initially, like, people started pricing in a cut in March, then they moved it out to June. And now they're saying we're going to have three rate cuts starting in July. But the situation has changed. Now you're starting to see inflationary pressures again. You've seen copper go parabolic. You've seen oil go up. You've seen metals go up, basic materials. I don't know if you've seen a chart of XLB recently, but that's on all-time highs. Like,
what is that? Is that the healthcare?
No, it's basic materials, XLB.
XLB. Yeah. Okay, got it. Yeah. Throwing cocoa too.
So yeah, you're starting to get inflationary pressures again. And if it made sense to ease policy a little bit at the end of 2023, it certainly doesn't now, which brings you to the political angle. Like, just the optics of the Fed cutting three times in successive meetings right before the election. That's insanity. That is absolute insanity.
Can I add something to what Jared just said too? Not only just cutting three times, which they basically said they're going to do, while they themselves raise their estimates for GDP, raise their estimates for PCE inflation, and then in the same breath say, yeah, but we still plan on cutting three times. The question of this is why. And I think I am 70% convinced that it's political as to why, but I am 30% convinced that he believes that there is a commercial real estate / banking crisis that could rear its head anytime in the next four months. Am I just crazy thinking that that's possible, that he thinks that?
No, I think that's right. I think that's right. Yeah.
I think so too. Do you want to get to the portfolio? I've been waiting for this too. This is the rest of it. The early part of it was called a tease in the media world because we're professionals. I don't know if you've noticed that, Jared.
We're so damn professional.
We're media people. So, but anyway, can you describe the perfect portfolio? The awesome portfolio is the way you describe it in the book, and I loved it. And I think it's probably such a good way to invest, to set it and forget it, like Ron Popeil would say. Can you describe it?
Well, first of all, I designed the awesome portfolio back in 2018. Sort of, if you remember what was going on in 2018, the conventional wisdom was that you would put all your money in the S&P 500, in the S&P 500 index, right? Why? Because it returns the most. That was the logic. It returns. You should do the thing that returns the most. Well, something that returns a lot probably has a lot of risk, you know, has a lot of volatility. And if you invest in an index, not only do you get the returns of the index, you get the volatility of the index. So what we have in this country is, it's the craziest thing. No other country does this. Nobody does this. Everybody in the U.S. puts their money in the S&P 500 and they experience massive volatility. You know, over a 40-year investing career, you're going to have like 15 or 20, 10% corrections. You're going to have 5 to 10, 20% bear markets. And probably once or twice, you're going to have a 50% bear market, right? And we're okay with this. We're going to experience this kind of, we're going to take these drawdowns, right? So the point of the awesome portfolio is to give you something close to the returns of the stock market without all the risk, right? So the awesome portfolio is 20% stocks, 20% bonds, 20% cash, 20% gold, and 20% real estate, okay? Going back to 1971, this portfolio has returned 8.1% a year with half the volatility of an 80-20 portfolio, and the max drawdown in any year was 12%. So you say, look, I could get 1% less than the stock market, and the worst year I'm going to have is down 12%. Where do I sign up?
Wow. And now it's even more attractive because when you said cash, and now that cash is in 3 month to 6 month bills, and it actually performs for you as well, correct?
Yeah. When I, it was funny because when I first came up with the awesome portfolio, cash yielded zero, and people said, are you nuts? Why do you have 20% in cash?
Yeah. And now you're laughing. And so tell me this, when you say this, that 20% in stocks, like break that up. You just say 20% in the S&P or some of it grows, some of it foreign?
I say the total market, so the VTI, so the Vanguard total market.
But nothing foreign, right?
I mean, look, you can slice and dice this however you want. I just did US, right? You know, now with the dollar as strong as it is, it kind of makes sense to diversify internationally, right? But I, for the purposes of the book, I just wanted to keep it really simple and use VTI.
Can you describe the vehicles that you may use to achieve this portfolio?
Yeah, so VTI for stocks, BND for bonds, GLD for...
By the way, is that BND for bonds? Is it U.S. Treasuries? Is it corporates? Is
that
everything?
That's a Vanguard Total Bond Market Index. So,
oh, I have it. Yeah. Okay, I know it. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
GLD for gold and VNQ for real estate. But one thing I said about real estate was you can count the equity in your house towards your real estate allocation.
That's interesting. I love it. Bobby?
Yeah. The last thing, honestly, that I had you from the book itself, or that I wanted to ask you from the book itself was, from a structural standpoint on the education side, you didn't really argue for the ROI of college as a general thing. Do you think it's just gotten to the point where unless you're going Ivy League, it just isn't worth it to pay that
money? Can I add on to his question before you answer too? Just another level of it. And what about the things that people study? Obviously, that matters as well, right?
Yeah, I didn't talk about that in the book. I actually don't think that matters as much as people think it does. You know, when I was at Lehman and I ran the ETF desk, the guy sitting next to me had a history degree. You know, he didn't have a math degree. He didn't have an engineering degree or a finance degree. He had a history degree. Another good friend of mine who was the CEO of a mutual fund company had an English degree, you know? So I don't think the major really matters. I mean, it sure it does for some people, but you can graduate from college with any major and do whatever the hell you want to do.
Interesting. My daughter did, I hope she fortunately she doesn't watch the podcast, but she came to us and said she wanted to get a psychology, philosophy degree. And we were like, well, that's great, but I mean, I'll take you to the bank to get loans. I'll pay for the engineering degree. Now, my guess is that you disagree with that sort of parenting philosophy, which by the way, I'm fine with, but I thought it was interesting. Then she got her engineering degree. And I said to her, when you go for your first job, even if it's a human resources job, someone sees an Illinois engineering degree, that gets you a little bit of a foot in the door. So you would agree for your first job, it probably helps.
Sure.
Right.
By the way, there's a very rich and famous person who has a philosophy degree.
Who's that?
Alex Karp, CEO of Palantir.
Really?
Yes. He's a philosophy PhD, actually.
To everything I'm against.
Here's a little anecdotal thing for you, Jared. Your publisher is Harriman House. They just rejected my first manuscript, which the weirdest thing about it, and I want to know if you have any opinion on this type of attitude. Now I want to write another one because they rejected it. I swear to God, if I sent them one and they said, this is fantastic, it would have bored the shit out of me. And they gave me the reason, and the reason was really good. Like, I wrote the book there was this marketing company we were going to work with in one of the things we do. And they said, we need a book that we can give away for free. And as I was writing it with a ghostwriter, because I can write articles, but I can't write that long, he just kept saying, no, don't give it away in this chapter yet. Don't give it away in this chapter. And the guys at Harriman said, I had to read 80% of the book before I got to the point. I was like, yeah, I guess that's completely fair, because that's how it was written. So it was written kind of this. So now I want to rewrite the whole damn thing. So I thought that was cool. What else have you done, and what else do you have coming up that people should be looking out for Like, obviously you have books that are your favorites. This is your favorite one of mine because it's the only one I read.
Well, this is my fourth book. The first one was in 2011, which was called Street Freak. And that was a memoir of me working at Lehman, which, by the way, was named the number one business book of 2011 by Business Week. So actually, the book won awards. The second one was a novel called All the Evil of This World in 2016. And then I had an essay collection published last year, and then this book, and then I have a short story collection coming out in November, and we'll see what comes out after that. So,
what was the All the Evils in This World book?
So that was about the dot-com bubble. Do you remember when 3Com spun off Palm?
Yeah.
Right? So in the book, there's a fictitious options trade that takes place around that spinoff, and it touches seven different people. So there's a clerk on the floor of the Peacoast, there's a market maker, there's a $2 broker, and then there's a bank in New York where you have a trader and a sales trader, and there's a hedge fund where you have an execution trader and a PM. So basically, each character has a chapter in the book, and each one is written in a different voice. And all of them kind of overlap, and there's a big payoff at the end. It's a really, really cool book. It's also the filthiest book you will ever read in your entire life.
I like that. Well, that's real. You know, Bobby's disclaimer for our podcast is pretty funny, that if you ever read it, it's this is the way people talk. You know, I've been on a trading floor for 37 years. Bobby was on a trading floor for 30 years. We are not shocked very often. I have another question about your writing, because if I could just write, I would write for 60 hours a week. I love writing. I love getting inside my head, being alone, the silence of it, but I don't have other jobs too. How much do you write in a normal week? How many hours?
I don't know about hours, but I write about 3,000 to 5,000 words a day, which I guess comes out to about 5 or 6 hours a day.
But sometimes they just come out like it's a faucet and sometimes not, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, with the Daily Dirt Nap, like, you know, I've been doing that for 16 years. It's pretty easy by this point. But if I'm writing fiction, it's harder and I'm, you know, it's slower. So.
And what do you need as background? Do you put on a flow state music? Do you put on anything? Or
I just like it to be quiet. I just like it to be quiet. So.
It's interesting you say that. When I do have to write, I set my alarm for about 3 a.m. I literally wake up 3 a.m, grab a double espresso that costs me $1. I don't give a shit if it could be 80.
Right? You high roller.
But yeah, I'm rolling away with it. And I'll sit in my office with the curtains on, my French doors closed, and it is just silent in here. And that's the only way. And the most I ever write is like 1,200 word articles. And that's so it.
Have you guys ever been to the Hemingway House down in Key West?
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
Because his system was too. And again, he was legendary for a late night carouser. But he had this little room that he'd go to every morning at like 6:30 a.m. when he'd wake up with his coffee before anyone else woke up. And Key West, you know, doesn't wake up very early, as you can imagine. And his first like 3 hours of the day would be his most productive, which I think is very interesting.
I don't have any more questions after this. I actually had written part of this question down, but I've been sparked more because our guest last week was Michael Gayed, who has a couple of ETFs. Great guy. Adds a lot of value, in my opinion. And a lot of people are throwing up in the comments saying, you know, he's not done well the last 3 years.
Yeah, we're getting beat up on that.
It's the dumbest thing. When I was at a hedge fund, I was part of the investment committee when I was at our hedge fund, 3 years was a blink. Like anyone who had 3 years of performance or less was considered emerging. Like they weren't even considered established. What advice do you have for people who think in that kind of a short-term view?
Oh my God. If you're trying to evaluate somebody's track record, whether it's a newsletter writer or a CTA or a hedge fund manager or something like that, you need at least 5 years and hopefully 10, because you need to see how people perform during cycles, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're looking at a 2-year track record and what you're seeing is somebody's performance in one half of a cycle, okay? And when the regime changes, that performance may flip. So yeah, you have to look at it over a long period of time.
People don't realize you can go back to in the last decade, no one has seen anyone's performance without a Fed balance sheet in expansion mode.
Yeah.
No one's seen anyone's performance in that. In a decade, in a damn decade. That's all I have, Jimmy.
Jared, will you tell the people where to find you, how to subscribe to the Daily Dirt Nap, all that
Well, first of all, please buy the book. The book is, let me pick it up.
I got it. You talk, I'll put it up.
No Worries, How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life. And like you said, get it for your kids. I would say age 16, maybe 15 or 16 is a good age, but even kids in college, get it for your kids. If you want to subscribe to the Daily Dirt Nap, go to dailydirtnap.com. If you mention the podcast, I will give you a discount. So please do that. Awesome. And you can follow me on Twitter at Daily Dirt Nap.
I will tell you that since I finished the book, you know that a 16-year-old can read it.
I will tell you, Jared, you changed my life last night. We're sitting down. We were watching this show back from 2007 called Burn Notice. I don't know if you guys ever heard of it.
Great book.
But all
great
of a sudden,
show. Great show.
All of a sudden, they took away the free, and it was, my wife was like, they want us to pay $22 for season two. And I brought up Jared Dillian. I brought up the book and said, we have done everything right. I will show you the commas in our bank account. Buy the damn season for $22. And we did. And we enjoyed the show. Season two wasn't as good as season one, but I will tell you it was very good. To you people who are watching, we'd like to take this time at the end to thank you. There'd be nothing without you and the support you guys give us. And you guys give us a shit ton of it. And we appreciate it. Remember what our mission here. Bobby and I were both in mainstream media for a long, long time. We both kind of got bounced out. Some of it by our own volition, some of it by our smart mouth, me. But anyway, so we are here. We are here to not have to shroud things, to put it to you guys straight, to not have to worry about what sponsors think of the things we say. If you like that goal, which I think you do, please retweet it. Please tell your friends. Thank you guys again for being here. This is The Future's Edge.